Well, sometimes in this program, you just never know what to expect, do you? And tonight, that's one of those nights. Who's behind the secret door? Three separate guests for the rest of the evening. I have no idea who they are. You'll find out with me until I beg for forgiveness. Then they'll have to tell me who they may be in case I don't get it. So we'll come back with guest number one in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Now, you know, it depends. Now, if we've had a guest on the program who's been on a lot, the chances are I just may guess who they are. But if we had a guest on who's been on once or twice and there's a long time in between, it might be tougher for me to guess who that person might be. And then you've got people like Roger Lear, and don't forget, keep saying a prayer for him so he gets better. When he comes on and he's been on once or twice behind the secret door, he changes his voice, and that's very difficult for me to find out who it is. So let's open up the secret door, first of all. There we are. So in comes our first secret guest. Hello there.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. I know when you hear my voice, Truman Capote will come to mind.
I was going to say that.
Yeah, but you know, I'm just here to tell you that's just not the case. I'm going to give you a clue. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. You know, if you were out in the wild and you were hunting for secrets, and what the Greeks call kryptos.
Okay.
What would you be hunting and who would you be hunting with?
I have no idea. Let me talk with you for just a little bit longer here before I get down and beg for forgiveness here. Have you been a regular Coast to Coast guest? You've been on a lot?
Well, I've been on quite a few years, yes, on and off. People know me if they heard me talk normally.
Because your voice is, you've changed it so much, are you a male or female?
Oh, I'm definitely male, at least last time I checked.
Okay, all right. I would have assumed that, but you never know.
Now remember, George, the clue is the Greek definition of a secret.
The Greek definition of a secret.
Crypto. You know,
Crypto.
Crypto.
Crypto. Mundo. Lauren Coleman?
Crypto. Not quite, but you're getting close. You're in the jungle. It's dark. You're
let me think. Let me think.
You see a being. He's got green skin. You're wondering what he is. He's got skills.
All right. You're a crypto expert, right?
Pretty close. I hunt cryptos.
You're John Rhodes.
That's right.
That may be one of the best voices I have ever heard. I thought for a split second you might be Evelyn Paglini, the Good Witch.
Oh, I love the androgynous comment that you made there, though, you know.
Oh, my God. Great job, John.
Thank you very much. You know, when you have a lot of alone time as a kid, you learn to entertain yourself. And by, you know, doing voices, it can be very entertaining. I've seen children do it. They're great at it.
A couple weeks ago, I watched a Showtime movie about Truman Capote. It was a movie, not a documentary. And you sound exactly the way he used to sound.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. I know he was quite an artist.
He sure was. So tell me,
he was quite an actor.
What's new with John Rhodes these days in the world of cryptozoology?
Oh, well, crypto hunting. Crypto hunting encapsulates a lot more than just the cryptozoological stuff, which you know me for, and a lot of people out there do. But I consider going out there and looking for secrets. You know, sometimes there's a lot of secrets out there and paperwork and old books out there on the internet that Google scanned, that they've done so many millions of books by now, they're not really editing them for great material. And there's some great material out there from like the 1800s or 19th century that's available through doing some scans and some great research for the last 100 or 200 years that we haven't heard or seen. I was actually crypto hunting the internet one night, and I discovered a document that was from the 2006 Anthropological Great Basin meeting that occurred, in which the representative, the chairman of the Pahrump Paiute Indian tribe, gave a PowerPoint presentation, and in this PowerPoint presentation that was given, it was research that was funded by the U.S. Air Force in the Nevada Test and Training Range, which, of course, encapsulates a lot of Area 51, the Tonopah Test Range, the Nevada Test Site, all of that area, which has that secret work going on up there. And in this study, one of the slides actually talks about their belief systems that they have, the Paiute have, and they actually say that underground, they still believe that there are beings with reptilian humanoid appearance living there, and that these are extraordinary beings. Now, remember, this is a report funded by the U.S. Air Force.
That's an amazing story. Might these be the ant people that the Hopis talk about, John?
Well, these are the snake people or the lizard people. The All ant right. people, I think, are the grays, which, of course, we now know because we see, look at an ant from a Hopi standpoint. If it's an ant on a rock, it's got a large bulbous head, large eyes. It seems to have thin extremities and arms. And then when they recognize these beings are coming up from underground and they see these like characteristics, they immediately consider them like an ant. They think of them as a part of nature, because that's what the Hopi are completely, imbued into, is all of nature. And in addition to that, you have these other beings, the snake people, that have been talked about through the desert Southwest Indian mythologies. And again, now we look at it from a modern perspective, we see these could possibly be what we perceive as the grays and the reptilian humanoids. You know,
John,
the Hopi word for ant is Anu, and, you know, in the same language, the word Naki means a good offering or a good prayer. So the combination of the Anu and Naki is kind of like ant friend or something like that. Now, that's kind of like the Anunnaki of Zachariah Sitchin talks about.
If you had to hone in on your expertise in cryptozoology, whether it's the search for Big Bird, Bigfoot, Thunderbirds, or Big Bird, what would you say would be your favorite subject?
Well, I guess what you know me best for, you know, having worked, you know, through the years bringing forth this information regarding reptilian humanoids, only because we're talking about a lot of colleagues of mine out there, they like to play it scientifically safe so they could be considered more serious, you know, by people in the scientific community. So they don't like to really talk about animals that may have achieved a high state of intelligence. They don't dare go through there. A lot of cryptozoologists, they don't want to enter that realm because they want to be taken seriously, what little credibility cryptozoology truly has. I mean, there's no degrees for it or anything. So when I'm out there looking for something that has achieved intelligence, perhaps a high degree of technological advancement, you know, even other people in my field like to separate themselves because they feel that's too much of a great leap. But it represents what most of us out there are thinking.
Reptilian humanoids, extraterrestrial, or were they always part of this planet?
I believe that this planet may have originally been theirs, and other beings that have come down have interacted with us. And so it's interaction of a reptilian humanoid planet and descendants of the giants or the elves that may have been actually military-industrial complex and others, elitists from the undersurface of Mars, because whatever disaster destroyed the surface, we don't know if it happened over hundreds of years or overnight, but the only ones that would have survived, given the state of disruption on the surface, where there's hardly a sign of life, then the ones who are underground, just like our military-industrial complex is underground, and they could remain there for thousands of years and never have to worry about it if they wanted to, the survivors would need to try and find somewhere else to colonize, and of course that would be nearby Earth. So you have these groups coming down, the gods coming down and taking humans and wanting humans from the ape-like man that was here and dumbing them down and using them as cattle, so we don't know the difference between good and evil. And then you have the serpents who came up saying, hey, listen, let's disrupt this slave race thing that they've got going on for these super giant elder gods, and let's give them intelligence. And once they did that, it was a real problem because humans were awakened. And now these two god-like entities, or what we call aliens now, but back then they called them gods, they both influence society. It hasn't been just the reptoids. It's also been this giant Nordic, blonde, blue-eyed, almost Nazi-like, militaristic, corporate intelligence type of being groups that consider them super gods. And again, we look back in history and think of these wars in heavens between these gods. Obviously, they're fighting over something. And it, from what historical record is, they want to fight over our belief systems. And so,
John,
therefore, we hold the power.
The devil has an uncanny resemblance to a reptilian. Is it possible that during these stories of Satan and the devil, that they might have been talking about one of these reptilian humanoids?
Mm-hmm.
Is that possible?
Yes, in the earlier traditions of from the Jewish literature, that was most of which was taken to comprise the Old Testament, the very beginning when they talk about Adam and Eve in the garden, the serpent they describe, they actually say he had hands and legs of a man. So this isn't just a normal snake they were talking about. But through time, that was simplified by the church because it brought up too many questions, and they just wanted to reduce it down to a symbol.
Yeah.
And so therefore they say that the snake lost his legs and hands. This is also in Egyptian mythology where they say the serpent, Nabu, has bound the snake and cut off his hands and legs.
Interesting.
It's almost an inference that, you know, the ability to walk with humans on the surface and to interact with them physically, meaning use their hands and interact with them, was taken away because they were pushed into the underworld and said, you have to remain there until a certain time, until one day when we'll let you back up into the surface. And perhaps at that time, you know, that's the point at which we're maybe looking forward to the great, you know, revealing of some great secret. Maybe that's it, that we share this planet.
We're talking with John Rhodes, who was our first guest behind the secret door. He's with us this hour. We're going to take your calls with him in just a moment. And had he not continued to give me clues, there's no way I would have guessed him with his great little voice that he had. His website, reptoids.com. We'll have them all linked up for you on coasttocoastam.com, but Lex can't put it up right away for fear that I'd go to the website and figure out who it was.
Oh, great. Well, you know, just to let your listeners know, I do actually have a link on the front page of reptoids.com. On the bottom left of the front page, you'll see it. It actually links to the graphic of in which they can see the actual presentation slide that Paiute introduced at that anthropological meeting in 2006 that described reptilian humanoids under Nevada.
David Icke has said that the power elitists on this planet are reptilian. Are we talking about one and the same here?
I think what we're talking about are groups of people who have aligned themselves with the symbol of a snake or a dragon because it's psychologically empowering, and they've seen it as such throughout history. And it also denotes power, wisdom, and all the things that the royalty like to think of themselves as having. In addition to that, it does appear as if there's been favored bloodlines through history, and those bloodlines, you know, going back even into the British royal family and such like that, they go back some distance. Now, the blue blood commentary can refer to several things. First of all, in ancient time or in modern, relatively modern history, the blue blood people were the royals because they never went outside. Their white skin was very white.
Mm-hmm.
If you were somebody who worked in the field, you were constantly exposed to sun, so you were never as polished white as the people that lived in these halls that hardly ever went outside. And the veins alongside the skin were such contrast that their blood really is a green color, greenish-blue color, until it's actually hitting oxygen and it turns red. So that looks through the skin, you get this idea that the elite are the blue bloods. But in addition to that, there is a process that takes place when an Rh-negative person and an Rh-positive person and such have children, and then there's an Rh-incompatibility, the Rh factor of their blood. So some of the children are born anemic, which means that they may have been lacking oxygen in their blood systems. They're born actually blue. And this anemia is a situation that sets up for quite some time. And these are the people that they see as being the byproduct of a certain bloodline that later on continues to become, to infiltrate the royal families. Now, are they reptilian? I would say they're as reptilian as you and I, to tell you the truth. Now, do they allow the dragon inside their soul to let them be brutal and very draconian in their thinking and non-caring, all the cold-blooded aspects, psychological aspects of a snake, or are they different? Well, most of us would say they've encapsulated all the cold-bloodedness parts of what we would think of as a snake. Now, there are some people out there that are Rh negatives, and they are considered possibly the reptilian humanoid hybrids, that some of these people have been influential through history, including the giants that had the red hair, in which we see many of their bodies and archaeological evidence of and architecture denoting some sort of an advanced knowledge by these tall, giant redheads that we've seen littering up across the planet. So with that red hair, that all tends to point back to the area of Ireland and Scandinavia, because the Rh-negative groups used to come mainly from there. 15% of their population's Rh-negative blood factor, whereas it's only 5% of the world. Interestingly enough, they call themselves sons of snakes and sons of dragons, the people that go back to the Tuatha Danann of the tribe of Dan, as it were, back in Ireland. And Edgar Cayce said in one of his sleeping prophecies, he said that evidence of the descendants of Atlantis would show up along in the Basque regions of bordering Spain and France, and this is where there's an extremely high concentration of Rh-negative blood, according to genetic scientists. In addition to that, Edgar Cayce pointed out Morocco, and most fascinating, that's another high concentration of Rh-negative blood type that are in there. So, you know, we're looking at all these different things, scientific points of view as well as prophetic, and we're wondering really what's happening and who's in charge.
How many of them might be on this planet? Any idea, John?
Could be small populations, I would imagine, much smaller than human populations, to be able to you know, keep their populations down and live long periods of time to sustain some sort of a culture over hundreds, if not thousands, of years. Now, maybe part of this thing about making us afraid of the reptoids and the reptilians is part of their plan, because there's so few of them that if they don't convince us they're really, really scary, then we might have the upper hand from the very beginning. So a lot of people don't consider that, you know. So even the idea of that we vilify them might be part of some sort of a mass mind control project in order to make sure that we think of them, if they arrive on Earth, a certain way. And so we have to look at modern movies that are being made and how they're presenting reptilian humanoid characters, because chances are that is a part of form of preconditioning. So if we see them as aggressors, then we have to wonder, if they're coming to this planet, are we being set up to believe they're aggressors even before they get here? Now, it's not impossible to think that we would be lied to even by our leadership or even by scientists, because by their own ignorance or whether by intent, we may not know.
Well, that's a good point. Stay with us, John Rhodes, our first guest behind the secret door. We'll come back in a moment and take questions for the cryptozoologist next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, we're going to take your phone calls next with John Rhodes, cryptozoologist, when we roll along in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. John, any speaking engagements coming up for you?
No live speaking engagements, although I just got done doing a Jesse Ventura and also a Weird or What with William Shatner episode. So people will be hearing new information coming out through those avenues.
Super. Super. Let's go to some of the phones for you. Let's go to Dallas, Texas. Keith, let's get us started here. You're up on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Keith.
Thanks for taking my call, George. I'm thinking about the science of what's happening underneath the ground and whether or not something could be living down there. And we know based on experiments that if you go down a certain level, the pressure increases, the temperature increases. And we know for a fact from the Russian that there is mantle miles and miles beneath the surface, which is extremely hot, so nothing could be living down there. But I think there's another way that something could be going on in this field that you're looking at, and that is that maybe there's more than one world occupying this same Earth. In other words, there could be life here on the surface on this plane of existence, but perhaps on another plane of existence, the interior of the Earth is not 10,000 degrees. It's not mantle. It's actually a place where life could exist and where there's vegetation and all sorts of things. And I'm wondering what you think about that.
Actually, I think there's some merit to what you're saying. First of all, as far as the temperatures and pressures, people have to realize that, you know, there's certain areas of the United States of the world that are geothermically active. In other words, you could sink a hole and start getting heat. You know, the Earth, I don't believe, has layers upon layers, like an onion, of evenly distributed thermal layers of heat and magma. These things channel through the rock, just like blood does through the human body, and it takes turns and twists like great rivers. And so there are areas that are cooler than others where you could actually get down quite deep. We know that through government documents, they've investigated the construction of underground bases as deep as 8 to 15,000 feet. So when you're talking at those depths, yes, we have the diamond mines in Africa that say it gets real hot down there. But remember, these men are using a lot of equipment. There's a lot of light. And they haven't fully developed their underground exploration to take into consideration heat sinking, which is taking the available heat you've got in an underground space and making sure that you can vent it out. Yes, they have jet engines that actually distribute oxygen at deep levels. So the underworld is extremely habitable, more so than we're led to believe. Yeah, there are some dangerous areas as well. In regards to going down to an area inside the Earth, yeah, we've had radar returns and echoes, seismic echo returns from earthquakes at deep levels that actually say that there's some sort of a shielding down there, but we don't know if it's exactly magma, liquid magma, or something even more hard. In addition to that, you know, you have too many beliefs of ancient societies, including the Masons, through their works in which they talk about the underworld being a place in which you can, there's works going down, like hollow, they're talking about the hollow earth, in which the earth was formed like a geode. And so therefore, when you crack it open, you see this hollow space filled with these crystals, that the actual inside of our planet has some sort of a habitable space. Now, is that can you reach it with your physical body? Most of the research indicates that as you descend down into the Earth, there's a high potential for actually the rotation of the Earth as you get closer is spinning at a faster rate. So you're starting to lose molecules that are spinning off your body through centrifuge. And as you get deeper and deeper into the Earth, you start needing less and less food because you're actually starting to lose atomic mass. Sometimes in ancient Tibet, they talk about the great white mystics that came up from the underworld that glowed. They would stand on the mountaintops and their bodies were glowing, but they couldn't stay for very long because their glow would diminish and they would have to go back underground. So you have to wonder, are these like people that go underground and inhabit a space in which physical reality is almost, you have to wonder what's distinguishable between the physical reality, because remember, plasma is a form of energy and matter that occupies a space between physical matter and pure energy, and it is considered the fourth state of matter. So what you're saying, I think that there's a great deal of merit to that, and it certainly deserves more scientific exploration, and it should not be looked down upon by people in the scientific fields with their high egos.
Let's go to Mankato, Minnesota. Jack, you're with us on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Jack. Thank you.
Hello, George. Hello, John. How are you this evening?
Good.
Fine, thank you.
Good. I'd like to take a moment, if I may, George. I'm sorry to hear about your father. I'm a regular listener.
Oh, thank you, Jack.
And John and George, I'd like to wish you both a very safe and happy holiday season.
Thank you very much.
I have a strange question, John. You said you just recently finished working with our ex-governor, Jesse Ventura, and William Shatner. I had mentioned when I called, the ancient Egyptians not only had human forms with dog heads, but also reptilian heads as well. And I've learned one thing as an old Trekkie, that Hollywood has an insight. And there used to be a movie called V.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you remember it or not, but it was about visitors from another planet that looked like humans that were underneath reptilian.
Right.
And I say that because William Shatner, when he did the first Star Trek movie, they were going through the movie and had introduced the first shuttlecraft called Enterprise. Well, at the time the movie came out, we didn't have a shuttlecraft called Enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some insight there. And from your standpoint, looking at what you say, underground people, I believe that this world is way too big, including Bigfoot and everything else, to believe that people can't live underground. But I believe reptilians and other forms of life could.
Right. You know, do you remember when Captain Kirk fought the reptilian humanoid Gorn?
Absolutely.
On the planet? Classic.
Now you're going back to TV.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I do believe that Hollywood has had a great deal of influence, but you've got to remember, a lot of Hollywood is run by certain, you know, groups. You know, a lot of the Jewish people control a lot of the entertainment business and such like that. So when you're seeing the films come out, are we really seeing a representation of something that's being let out through creative means, or something that's being let out through means of desensitization? I do believe that a large part of our television and film programming since the last 20 years, coming from the time of Jurassic Park and Barney the Dinosaur, if you see that there's been that long ongoing trend that's been very heavy, and I do think that there's a process of desensitization that's taking place that prepares us for something that's going to be happening.
You know, a lot of us have thought that, John, for some time, that you know, Hollywood is the buffer before an event unfolds. You know, a lot of people have thought, for example, that Steven Spielberg might have been getting inside information whenever he did Close Encounters of the Third Kind or E.T., the extraterrestrial. They're interesting theories, aren't they?
Well, absolutely. They certainly are. You know, even Enemy Mine and such, where they talk about a holy book reference to the Talmud and how one person or one how sometimes disasters can unite different species or bring enemies together. I think the lessons are all there because we've been conditioned through history to be afraid of a life form like this by the church. And let me tell you something, most of what the early church did was an issue of control. So if they demonize the snake, there's an issue they have with the snake, and it may not be for the normal person, because religions lose their power when they lose their belief, their congregation's belief system. And when you are looking at something like a reptilian humanoid appearance, you have to be wondering to yourself also, what's the Catholic Church going to say? We know they've built the observatories. We know they've said that they can convert, you know, even aliens to different forms of Catholicism if the aliens should want to go down that path. But I would say that it's going to be a very interesting question when they start facing something that is akin to what we pulled out of that craft in Roswell. Remember, it was described as having reptilian skin, beaded skin like a lizard, and also the small suction cups on its fingertips, which are, like I've said before on your show, a signature of an arboreal or a tree lizard. When you put those facts together with one of the most famous UFO cases in American or global history, we're certainly looking for something like that to return and take center stage.
Okay, next up, let's go to Lewis in Buffalo, New York. Hey, Lewis, thanks for calling. Lewis, you with us? Nope, no Lewis in Buffalo, but let's go to Tess driving around in California. Hi, Tess.
Hi.
Hey, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tess. Well, thank you for having me, George, and condolences because of your father. And okay. Hi, John.
Hello, Tess.
I wanted to ask, I'm actually from Australia, so if you don't understand what I'm saying, just ask me to repeat the question. I wanted to know your take on what you thought about Jesus and God and religion into your theory of these snake people, dragons.
All right, any tie in there?
That's an interesting question. It's a loaded question, of course, but I'm willing to tackle it.
Go for it.
I think that we should look back at it and recognize that some people say, you know, that Jesus was not a real man, and others say that he was a fictional character based on the sun, solar worship evolving out of Egyptian and Phoenician areas. And I would say most likely he was both. He was a man that recognized the importance of these ancient traditions and also recognized that in order to move a religious movement forward, there had to be the return of this son of God in order to make the solar sacrifice, in which he puts himself out for, and sacrifices himself for everyone around him and to uplift people. And at that time in history, he may have taken it upon himself to fulfill that. Now, we know that, you know, obviously we're talking about a very learned man. Back in those days, he was more of a Gnostic than he was what we would consider a traditional Christian of today, which means that there was the serpent played a huge impression upon the people who we know as the Essenes, who later evolved into the Gnostics. And that area of our Western religion was crushed out by the Roman Catholic Church. They wanted nothing to do with it. The eagle, the angel man, had defeated the snake man. And so, therefore, the snake man was vilified. My take on that is that I believe that there is some form of a consciousness, perhaps, or some beings that are going to be returning to our planet. And maybe not in December 21st, 2012, which I'm happy to say thank you very much for inviting me on at the 11th hour at the eve of the one-year anniversary of the countdown to December 21st, 2012, George. I wanted to remember to thank you for that. It's an honorable position.
Well, you know, you can thank Tommy, too. He's Mr. Surprise here.
Oh, absolutely. Tommy's always a surprise. But what we may be looking for is some of our Western traditions also say that what we're expecting is actually going to happen when we're not expecting it. It's going to happen earlier or later, most likely earlier. It's going to take us by surprise. Now, I would say we should start looking forward to June 5th, 6th of this year, 2012, coming up, which is only 167 days away, because that's when Venus transits the sun. In other words, it crosses the path from the left to the right on the upper portion of the visible sun, and it does this very few times. It happens in pairs, and it is going to be happening again in June 5th, 6th, 2012. And now, when you consider what the symbol of Venus is the snake, the carrier of light, the Mother Mary, Jesus was also known as the bright early morning star. We look at that symbolism and merge it with what the ancients used to think of as the sun, like the father, and then the mother, which is the Venus female green symbol, and the earth. And I think that this is going to play a really large part in everything that's going on, more so even than other dates that we have in mind. We have to remember that the Mayans, their whole world was wrapped around Venus and the cycles of 13. And we are coming up to this point where Venus transits the earth, where, if you can imagine it from a Mayan's point of view, whoever was there in 1991, July 11th of 1991, operating the small disc craft over the crowds while everybody watched the solar eclipse of 1991, they are most likely going to be over the skies of Mexico City, I have no doubt, this coming June 5th, 6th of 2012. So we have to look forward to that date.
Very good. Let's go to Chuck in Raleigh, North Carolina. Hey, Chuck. Welcome to the program.
Hey, George. How you doing?
Okay, Chuck. Sure thing. Go ahead.
Last time I talked to you was on your birthday a couple of days ago. I was driving my truck through Dallas, and tonight I'm sitting in Raleigh.
You're everywhere.
Yes, I'm everywhere. Actually, I wanted to ask John about the Piassa bird, and I was wondering if maybe he thought it was a dragon. I mean, we see dragons all over the place in Europe and Asia, and my family's from around, you know, the St. Louis area, and I've always been interested in the Piassa bird, and I just kind of wanted to know what he thought about it.
Do you know that story? It's the bird that the Native Americans trapped and captured, and it was supposed to be one of these thunderbirds, John.
The Piassa bird, right. We wonder if it could have been some form of or descendant of the pterodactyls or the large birds that, you know, with the bat-like wings. We also know that when we've heard stories, Native American myths, and match those up with things that we hear like on our East Coast with the Mothman prophecies, this is a flying being as well. And from a great distance, if you have nothing to reference it to, you might think it's also a bird. I do believe that there are sometimes nature produces some remarkable abstracts to the norm. In other words, we sometimes have giant humans that are towering above everybody else. And it could be that there are, before they died out or went into extinction, remnants of a form of large birds that were revered by the Indians in the desert southwest, and that they may have actually had sightings of them. Now, why are we not finding their fossils or anything like that? Well, remember, fossils are only represent a very small portion of what is ever left over on the surface after so much of a mass of that life has disappeared and gone. So it's really a crap toss trying to even find the bones. But there is something to it. We also know that winged beings in the night have come down and swooped upon people. I keep thinking back to that movie about in the desert there were reptilian humanoids living underground. And it was a very famous movie out of the 1950s. It kind of skips my mind right now, but The Gargoyles, that's right. And it was a great film, but, you know, we don't know if maybe some cavern systems actually have winged humanoid beings living in them. We know that we've seen the flying witches or flying beings also down in Mexico, but, you know, we're not hearing the Thunderbirds in Mexico, but we hear more of a traditional type of a witch description, which makes me wonder, you know, is it some sort of UAV that's disguised itself so people just report a flying witch instead of a flying drone? Or are we really dealing with beings that are out there flying around and that have actually been the basis of a lot of these traditional myths? And we're not exactly sure. But I think, again, that's an area in which somebody I wish would study as hard as, you know, some of us have studied other areas of cryptozoology, because it's deserved.
John, will we ever find Bigfoot?
Oh, I think we will. I think that we're going to find that Bigfoot and reptilian humanoids are occupying remote areas of the planet and are encountered on occasion. And they're just a little bit more wild than others of their same kind, probably because they live in such remoteness and maybe near the surface of the Earth. So they're a little bit more primitive as opposed to the more conscious ones or intelligent ones, I would say. And I use that description carefully, because intelligence is a matter of frame of reference. So, yeah, I do believe we're going to see it. I also think that we're going to see that some of these beings are a cross between mammal and reptile, because we have to remember, we thought of dinosaurs as reptiles, but we know now that birds are evolved dinosaurs, but we think of them as warm-blooded. So somewhere along the line, cold-blooded reptiles became warm-blooded mammals, birds, what we think of as birds. So that really, that idea of saying, well, it's got to be a mammal Bigfoot or a reptilian reptoid, it's going to somewhere along the line, I think, blur, because we're going to see something come up that maybe has a mixture of both primitive scale structure and hair follicles.
All right, my friend John Rhodes, thank you so much for being on the program. John's website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Up next, another person behind the secret door. Let's see if I can guess who it is. We'll be right back on Coast to Coast AM. Don't touch your dial.